As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
I know I'd go from rags to riches.
To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged.
For decades, Hollywood has dramatized the takedown of the American mafia, from heists and wiretaps to undercover agents. But behind many of those stories were real investigations carried out by agents working the cases on the ground. Neil Moran was one of those agents. It's Newstalk Daily, I'm Ciara Doherty. And during his career with the FBI, Neil Moran worked on landmark investigations that would later inspire some of the most famous crime movies ever made. That includes the robbery at JFK Airport, then the largest cash and jewellery robbery in the United States history, which inspired the movie Goodfellas.
When they found Carbone in the meat truck, he was frozen so stiff it took them 2 days to thaw him out for the autopsy.
Moran spent years investigating organized crime networks in New York, carrying out surveillance, planting listening devices, and tracking the movements of mob figures connected to the city's five families.
Well, let me just say, go ahead and try and sell it. You want to be a Dunsky? Give it a shot.
Dunsky? You call me a Dunsky? You know who you're talking to, my friend?
Hey, left. Come on, have a spritz.
You want to go embarrass yourself with this thing?
Embarrass myself? My family, my children, my mother can hold her head up in any neighborhood in the city where she walks down the block. In all the five boroughs, I'm known. Forget about it.
He also worked alongside the real-life Joseph Pistone, whose undercover work infiltrating the mafia later became the film Donnie Brasco. Now Moran has written a memoir about that career, from truck hijackings and mob investigations to undercover operations and life inside the Bureau. The book is called Stories. And I'm delighted to say that Irish-American Neil Moran joins me now. Neil, you're very welcome to News Talk Daily.
First of all, thank you so much for having me. This is not every day I get to address an Irish audience. This is a big thrill for me.
I should point out, you're speaking to us in your own right today, and your views, we should note, are not representative of the Bureau as a whole. And Neil, let's just start, I suppose, with you joining the FBI back in 1971 and that journey to become an agent within the FBI. What drew you to them, and what do you think it was about you that meant that you had the characteristics that said, yes, I am suited to be an agent, an FBI agent?
I come from largely a civil service family. My dad was a New York City fireman, uncles in the New York City Police Department. I think with the culture of civil service being in the minds of first generation Americans, as my parents were, it was always ingrained in them to get a pension, even though you wouldn't be making a lot of money. Pension was very important. Benefits were very important so you could take care of your family. That civil service mentality, I think, was ingrained in a lot of people like myself from our Bronx neighborhood. Interestingly enough, I wasn't exposed to the FBI at all until, as a teenager, we moved to the suburbs, and the community that we lived in, of the 50 or so homes in our development, the most prevalent occupation were FBI agents. There were about five or six of them. It seemed very interesting to me, and I was drawn to that. My father actually, once I started to show some interest in the FBI, my uncles, my father's cousins who were in the police department, they all urged me to go in that direction and give it a shot. To this day, New York City Police Department, although has changed in recent years with more of an international presence, New York City Police Department has had to recruit from all kinds of cultures and for the better to make it stronger and you know, more of a threat to those who want to harm America. Yeah, it's just always been the fire department, the police department have always attracted Irish Americans.
So you joined the FBI after a couple of years of being an employee. You became an agent and you're based in New York. When I think about that era, the 1970s in New York, you must have been working through one of the most volatile times in the city, the emergence of these major mafia families, organized crime dominating the headlines and really, I think, shaping people's perception of what New York City was.
This is a familiar scene in America these days. Arson is our fastest growing crime, affecting the lives and property of millions of people. No city is immune.
This is the Bronx in New York. 1.5 million people live in this borough, equal to the population of Houston or Washington or San Diego. It's the home of the New York Yankees, the Bronx Zoo, and the Grand Concourse. It has also become the arson capital of the world. Once that smoke on the horizon signified industry, progress, jobs. Now it means someone is burning down a building, a landlord for profit, a tenant for revenge, junkies, vandals. It happens 30 times a day, and the flames are the signal of a national disaster.
Here, it was literally trial by fire. I had never lived anyplace else besides New York. So there's a process when you go through your training in Quantico, Virginia, where you pick three offices that you would like to land. I wanted to go someplace outside of New York to see what it was like. That wasn't in the cards. They sent me right back. But you know what? It was the most fortuitous thing that ever happened. I got thrown right into the fray. I got back in August of 75. In September of 75, some of your listeners might remember, two presidential assassination attempts on then-President Gerald Ford. First by a member of the Manson family, Charles Manson family, Lynette Squeaky Frome, who did not get a shot off. She had a gun, but did not get a shot off in California. Less than a month later, I think it was 3 weeks later, Sarah Jane Moore did get a shot off, did not harm the president. But both those cases had connections with New York. And the senior agent, Tom O'Hara, took me under his wing. And I was working on two presidential assassination attempts within weeks of arriving in New York.
All of a sudden, a young woman dressed in a red flowing gown jumped at the president, lunged at him, and we're told she had a gun in her hand, a Secret Service.
The White House press office has now identified the woman as Lynn Ellis Fromm, 26 years old, of Sacramento, and they say that she is linked with the Charles Manson family.
3 weeks later, a rerun. On September 22nd, in another California town, San Francisco, another radical, another gun, the same president. Sarah Jane Moore's motives were confused. Her purpose was not.
And after I fired the shot, he stopped cold, and I did have time for a second shot, had never planned for a second shot, had practiced and was psyched for one shot.
In addition to that, the FALN was a terrorist Puerto Rican independence group. In the 70s and 80s, were responsible for 120 bombings. A good many of those bombings were in New York City. The squad that I was initially assigned to had responsibility for bombings. So those were some of the things, in addition to things like bank robberies and extortion and kidnapping. Those were some of the more major things that I worked as well.
Okay, so you're right in there, right on the front line. And you see, what was also one of the most fortuitous things to happen to you was that you were assigned to the truck hijacking squad. There were two truck hijacking squads in New York City at the time, because actually a lot of the individuals who were very successful within that area, and I mean criminals successful within that area, went on to become really senior members of the five organized crime families working within New York.
Correct. So every new agent gets a stint on these very prestigious squads that I spoke about, doing bombings, doing kidnappings, doing extortions. And then you get transferred to one of the less glamorous squads, if you will. And so I did my time. The squads that I was assigned to in between were very rewarding, but all the young people wanted to get either on the bank robbery squad or the truck hijacking squad. So I was assigned to truck hijackings. It took a couple of years, but in early 1978, I began to work on the truck hijacking squad. And it was my first initiation into organized crime. And many of the people that we dealt with at the time, including those that we'll talk about, I guess, from the Lufthansa robbery, these were all truck hijackers. Anybody who's seen Goodfellas and those first, in the first half hour, the Ray Liotta character, Henry Hill, talks about. Anytime we needed money, we went to JFK Airport.
By the time I grew up, there was $30 billion a year in cargo moving through Idlewild Airport. And believe me, we tried to steal every bit of it. So you got to understand, we grew up near the airport. It belonged to Paulie. And we had friends and relatives who worked all over the place, and they would tip us off about what was coming in and what was moving out. If any of the truckers or airlines gave us any trouble, Paulie had his union people scare them with a strike. It was beautiful. It was an even bigger moneymaker than numbers, and Jimmy was in charge of it all. Whenever we needed money, we'd rob the airport. To us, it was better than Citibank.
And we spent loads of our time surveilling people that were actually responsible for the Lufthansa robbery when they were truck hijackers. So interesting to see these people elevate themselves in future years to become soldiers in families, capos in families. And in one case, a case of a fellow named Joey Messina, became head of the Bonanno family.
When people think, I suppose, of organized crime and they think of New York at that time, they often think of the major cases like the takedown of the Gambino crime family or the conviction of one of the bosses like John Gotti.
Right.
From your experience, what makes those organized crime investigations so complex? And bring me through some of the investigative techniques that you would have used when you were in the FBI.
The advent of the RICO statute, which was is short for Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations. That was a tool that Congress gave the federal government to establish patterns. So in other words, the conviction in the John Gotti case, late 80s, early 90s, were decades long in the making as far as putting together a series of crimes to show that the Gotti family literally was an enterprise. It was an enterprise. It was an organized crime family. But as far as the government was concerned, it was an enterprise. And the way that government proved that was a series of crimes, series of homicides, series of extortions, shylocking, extorting money from people, all crimes that they could prove as people began to cooperate with the FBI, which was unheard of. I mean, one thing that I can tell you from working truck hijackings back in the 70s, the code of omerta in the mafia was strictly adhered to. We couldn't get people to cooperate on a simple truck hijacking. And then to see these people, major crime figures in major crime families, slowly start to cooperate with the government, you know, in particular in the FBI, was actually stunning. But in the case of bringing down the Bonanno family, I mentioned Joey Messina earlier. He is referred to as the last Don. He cooperated. The head of a family cooperated. The underboss of the Gambino family, Sammy the Bull Gravano, cooperated. This was unheard of when I first broke into the FBI.
So how did that come about then? Because so many of these mafia cases, as you say, hinged on insiders, senior insiders within these groups flipping over. How did that happen?
So in the case of John Gotti, and then this goes to show you how, you know, being kind to people, no matter what you might think of them, comes back very often to pay off. So you had two senior agents in the New York office who were assigned to the arrest of Sammy the Bull Gravano. As they brought down John Gotti. As the attorneys were meeting in the Metropolitan Correctional Center, where both Gotti, Gravano, and their underboss, Frank LoCascio, were housed, it became evident that the goal of the attorneys was to make sure that John Gotti got off. And Sammy Gravano saw the handwriting on the wall that he was going to be thrown under the bus here. So he reached out to the two senior New York agents and said, you need to help me out. The federal prosecutor at the time, later a federal judge, John Gleason, ushered Mr. Gravano out of the Metropolitan Correctional Center, met with him, and the next thing you know, he was being transported to Quantico, Virginia to be debriefed and was the main witness in the successful prosecution of John Gotti. In the case of Joey Messina, who was the head of the family, he actually faced the death penalty, the federal death penalty. And as he didn't want to die, so to save his own skin, he cooperated. He cooperated with the FBI. and brought down the entire Bonanno family.
I mean, you get the sense that investigating this type of organized crime back in the 1970s, given the limitations, I suppose, with some of the investigative technology that you would have had at your disposal, that it was complex, but it must have been dangerous as well. Did you ever feel personally at risk during these kind of investigations?
You know, there was somewhat of an unwritten understanding between the mob and the government. They generally didn't go after prosecutors and agents. You know, there's a scene in the beginning of Goodfellas when young Henry Hill is talking about that guys in the neighborhood carry the mother's groceries home. And he says, you know what? It was all out of respect. Oh, that is a very real thing with these guys.
One day, some of the kids from the neighborhood carried my mother's groceries all the way home. You know why? It was out of respect.
Hi, Mom. What do you think? Look at my shoes. Aren't they great?
My God. You look like a gangster.
I do address it in my book. A bunch of us detectives and agents frequented a gym in Queens, and there was an individual there who was a union boss that, you know, kind of liked to throw his weight around in the gym. And he approached me when he found out, actually, that I was an agent. He approached me, of all places, in the shower, where he was pretty confident that I wasn't wearing a wire, and told me that he had been subpoenaed, and one of the agents on one of the squads really wasn't showing him respect. He claims he knocked on the door, banged on the door at 5 o'clock in the morning to serve him a subpoena. And he was kind of rude and embarrassed him in front of his family. But I did approach the agent and I said, he came to me and, you know, and he expressed himself. I said, you know what? I'm not trying to tell you what to do or how to run your investigation. I said, but you might want to think about, you never know, he might cooperate. He gets in jail and is having a rough time of it in jail. Maybe he'll cooperate. He'll reach out for you someday. And sure enough, about a month later in the shower, the guy corners me again. He says, I know you talked to him. I know you talked to him. He says, it's a different, completely different attitude. These guys, respect is a real big thing with them. And, you know, if you're, as in the case with Sammy Gravano, those two senior agents that were kind to him showed him some, you know, some compassion. He reached out for them and cooperated. As far as the danger aspect, Kira, I did do one long-term undercover operation where we were involved with organized crime. It was an undercover sting, automobile sting. We were taking insurance jobs on people's cars from body shops, and we were supposedly the people that were receiving these cars and chopping them up for parts. Those people that we dealt with, they were businessmen. They were street people, and we passed ourselves off as street people. We were tow truck drivers for a year, my partner and I. We ran a junkyard. We did get threats in the beginning, and some of the people that we were introduced to, one individual in particular said, you know, if you guys turn out to be cops, I'll kill yous both. So on the day of the arrest, we did have a New York City detective in charge of his arrest, who was about 6'4 and about 250 pounds. And he made it clear to him that if anything ever happened to agents Moran and Hanna, that he'd have to answer to him.
The Red Baron was caught napping, and not by amateurs either. This band of robbers had everything down pat and made the entire caper from beginning to end go as smoothly as Swiss clockwork. Shortly before 4 this morning, while the moon was on the wane, a black Ford van slipped out of the shadows in the cargo area and stopped at a padlocked gate of the adjacent Argentine Airlines. One snip with heavy bolt cutters, and that security checkpoint might as well not have been there. The band of robbers, 6 and perhaps 7 men wearing ski masks, drove around to the loading dock. When they jumped one Lufthansa worker, his screams made a security guard inside open the door. That was the end of security.
Look, one of the movies I think that is loved by people right around the world is Goodfellas, which we know was inspired by the real-life robbery 12 years earlier of the Lufthansa cargo terminal at JFK Airport in New York, when a crew of Lucchese crime families made off with nearly $6 million in cash and jewellery. It was a really daring heist just 2 weeks before Christmas. You went to watch that movie, and there was a scene within it, wasn't there, that you recognised as really being very true to the investigation that you had been carrying out on that family.
So one of the upfront guys responsible for the armed robbery at the Lufthansa terminal that morning in December was Angelo Seppi. He's the Frankie Carbone character in the movie. Tommy DeSimone, played by Joe Pesci, was another one of the upfront guys. Jimmy Burke, interestingly enough, was not one of the people at the airport that night. He was on the outskirts. He was the alleged mastermind. So there are several other individuals that participated, but the primary person that I was assigned to as we began to develop information over the course of the a week or two, right around Christmas Day, actually, we began to focus on the people that we had informant information that were responsible for the robbery. And one of them that I was assigned to was a fellow named Angelo Seppi. And there is a scene in the movie where they come to this place called Robert's Lounge. And I'm sure your listeners will recall Robert De Niro is the Jimmy Burke character, is Jimmy Conway in the movie, is very annoyed at the couple as they walk in, and the wife has a fur on and he's got a pink Cadillac, and he balls him out and he says, return this thing and return the car.
It's a wedding gift. I don't give a fuck whose name it's on. Are you stupid or what? Did you hear what I said? Don't buy anything. Don't get anything. Nothing big. Did you hear what I said? What's the matter with you? You get excited. Should I get excited about? Because you're going to get us all fucking pinched. That's why. What are you, stupid? What's the matter with you? I apologize. What's the matter with you?
Well, Angelo Seppi actually went out and bought the most popular brand new car in that neighborhood, in the neighborhood of what we call Howard Beach and Ozone Park. That's where all these organized crime figures lived. And Angelo goes out and buys a brand new 1978 Ford Thunderbird with a very distinctive rust top and a navy blue body. It was a beautiful car. It was the single most popular car in those two neighborhoods. You could not drive a block and not see this car. It had very distinctive taillights. So when we're following Angelo, no matter what kind of traffic we were in, we could see him up above, ahead of us, many cars ahead of us. And we were busy 99% of the time following him until the wee hours of the morning. There comes a time in the movie when Robert De Niro is in the phone booth. He's checking to see if everything went through. Whoever the contact was he called said, he's gone. We couldn't do anything about it. And in the background, there's Angelo's car. So we all got the biggest charge out of that. I mean, because, you know, following that car, you know, for as many months as we did, you know, 24/7, to see it in the movie was pretty pretty special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's this?
This is Vinny.
Vinny, what happened? Well, did we get straightened out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean. He's gone. And we couldn't do nothing about it. That's it.
What do you mean? He's
gone. He's gone.
Finally, why do you think, Neil, we have always been so fascinated by these stories, by these cases, and why they have made a reappearance on screen and been so successful?
You know, I know a lot of these people are treacherous. There's a charisma with a lot of them. A lot of them, as I point out in the book, we arrested a guy one time. We got an anonymous call on a Saturday. We all got called at home down to one of the Brooklyn piers, and a guy named Lenny D. Maria. We came on the scene. We come onto the pier. They're loading from a tractor trailer all the stolen goods onto small rental trucks. And we come in with lights and siren, probably about six or seven of us. And they start to run, which was quite comical to see, you know, a lot of these guys who are, you know, obese try to run to get away. And after about 50 yards, they all stopped. But one fella, we're putting the handcuffs on him, Lenny D. Maria, and he said, I didn't know you guys work weekends. We would never have done this. He says, I didn't think you guys work weekends. So a lot of them do have senses of humor. One of the things that that I always used as a, you know, I think that's a good rule, as did the people I worked with. Treat people the way you would want to be treated. And I think we were always gentlemen with these guys, no matter what they were like.
Thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk Daily. That's it from today's edition of the podcast and for the week here on News Talk Daily. If you missed anything during the week, you'll find every one of our now 200 episodes on the Go Loud Player and at newstalk.com. And there was some good stuff this past week, if I do say so myself, including our unmasking of the artist behind the famous nickname Banksy, as well as Malachy Brown's story of how he proved American responsibility for that devastating school bombing in Iran. And I do recommend you listen to both of those. Just search for News Talk Daily wherever you listen to your podcasts and be sure to give us a like or follow. Until Monday morning, bright and early. Goodbye.